me. She began to weep. Ah, ye gods! He promised me! Nevin caught her in his arms and let her sob. Finally she fell silent, so silent that he was frightened, but she'd merely fallen asleep in a merciful exhaustion. He woke her just enough to get her to lie down on the blankets and sleep again. In the morning, Bronwyn fell into a dream state. She never spoke, refused to eat by turning her head away like a stubborn child, and had to be lifted onto the horse. All morning they rode slowly, avoiding the roads and sparing the burdened horse as much as possible. If they hadn't been riding to Frega, Nevin would have been overwhelmed by despair. She was broken, crushed like a silver cup that falls beneath a warrior's boot when his troop is looting a hall. Frega could help her. Nevin clung to that hope, but Frega was over a day's ride away. Occasionally Nevin thought of the Boar's war band riding for revenge. The page had doubtless reached them before dawn. They were, doubtless, already on their way to the Falcon, with Blaine's young brother Camlan, Lord Camlan now, at their head. Nevin supposed that Geraint would flee ahead of them into a miserable exile's life. Close to sunset, Nevin and Bronwyn came to the river that would, on the morrow, lead them to Frega. After he made their camp, Nevin tried to get Bronwyn to eat or speak. She would do neither. All at once, he realized that she was planning on starving herself to death to keep her vow to the gods. Though it ached his heart, he used the only weapon he had.
"And what are you doing? Starving the baby inside you? The poor little thing is cursed indeed if its own mother won't feed it."
Her eyes brimming tears, Bronwyn raised her head. She looked at him, then took a piece of bread and began to nibble on it. When Nevin gave her cheese and an apple, she ate it all, but she never spoke a word. He gathered more wood for the fire, then made her lie down near it where she could be warm. When he went through their meagre provisions to see what was left, he found, wrapped in a piece of cloth, every courting present he'd ever given her. Luther had sent them all along. Nevin looked for a long while at the jewelled brooch in the shape of a falcon, and thought of Geraint. When the night turned dark, and Bronwyn had fallen fast asleep, Nevin finally gave in to his wandering and built up the fire to scry. With so much terror and pain behind it, the vision built up fast, showing him the great hall of the Falcon. Blaine's body was laid out by the hearth, with a pillow under his head and his sword on his chest. When Nevin sent his mind to Geraint, the vision changed. Out in the ward, Geraint was pacing back and forth with his sword in his hand. He had refused to flee his weird. Nevin never truly knew how long he kept that last watch with Geraint. Once, the fire burned so low that he lost the vision, but when he laid more wood in, he scried Geraint out immediately, pacing, 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 his sword swinging back and forth, the blade glittering in the torchlight. At last, Nevin heard the sound, just as Geraint did, tossing up his head like a stag. Horses, a lot of them, clattering up the hill. Geraint strolled to the gates and positioned himself between them with his sword raised at the battle ready. With his warband behind him, Lord Camlan rode into the pool of torchlight, while Geraint stood and smiled. When Camlan drew his sword, the warband did the same.
"Where's my brother's body?"
"By my hearth. Bury one of my horses with him, will you?"
His young face troubled, Camlan leaned forward in the saddle to stare at the friend who had become his enemy. Then the troubled look disappeared, swept away by the cold, honourable rage of the Avenger. He flung up his sword, keened once, and spurred his horse forward. The men charged and ringed Geraint round. In the mob, Nevin saw Geraint's sword flash up, bright with blood in the torchlight. A horse reared, men shouted, then the mob pulled back. Geraint was lying dead on the ground. His cheek bleeding from a sword cut, Camlan dismounted and walked over to kneel beside him. He raised his sword, two-handed, and cut Geraint's head off. He rose, swinging the head by the hair, and with a howl of rage he flung it hard against the wall. The scream broke the vision, Bronwyn's scream. Nevin scrambled up and ran to her just as she rose, sobbing.
"Gero! He's dead!"
Gero, Gero, Gero! Her voice rose to a shriek. Camlan! Are ye gods? Are ye gods? Gero!
Nevin flung his arms around her and pulled her tight. Bronwyn struggled, throwing herself back and forth in his arms while she keened for her brother and the father of her child. Nevin held on tightly and grimly until at last she fell silent.
How did you know? Gwenny, tell me, how did you know?
Bronwyn only wept, an exhausted tremble of her body. Nevin stroked her hair and held her until at last she seemed calmed. When he let her go, she threw her head back and keened again. And so it went for hours. He would just soothe her when something would make her remember, and she would keen, struggling with him. Slowly, her struggles grew weaker. He got her to lie down on the cloaks, then lay down next to her and let her weep in his arms. When she at last fell asleep, he watched the fire burning itself out until he too drifted off, as exhausted as she. But he woke not an hour later and found her gone. Nevin jumped to his feet and ran for the river. He could just see her there, poised on the bank, a dark shape against the sky.
Gwenny!
She neither turned nor hesitated, but flung herself into the river before he could reach her. Weighted by her long dresses, she went down, swirling away into the darkness. Nevin dove in after her. Black, the cold shock of the water, he could barely breathe or see. The current swept him along, but as he broke the surface and came up, he saw nothing but black water scouring ahead of him. If she'd sunk already, he could easily be swimming over her. Yet though he knew it was hopeless, he kept diving, kept swimming back and forth across the river like a dog seeking a water bird. All at once the current swirled him and rammed him hard against a sharp something in the dark. A rock. With his shoulder aching like a fire, Nevin managed to pull himself to the riverbank and out, but only barely. He lay gasping and weeping on the bank for a long time. Just as the grey of dawn lightened the sky, Nevin got up and walked downstream. He was too mad with grief to know what he was doing. He merely walked, looking for her. As the sun came up, he found her where the current had washed her into a sandy shallows. She lay on her back, her golden hair sodden and tangled, her beautiful eyes wide open, staring sightlessly at the brightening sky. She had fulfilled her vow to the gods. Nevin picked her up, slung her weight over his uninjured shoulder, and carried her back to camp. All he could think was that he had to get Gwenny home. He wrapped her in both cloaks and tied her over the grey's saddle. It was close to nightfall when Nevin reached the hut in the forest. Rega came running out and stopped, looking at the burden in the saddle.
"You were too late."
"It was too late from the first day he bedded her."
Nevin brought her down and carried her inside, laid her down by the hearth, then sat down beside her. While the light faded in the hut, he looked at her, simply looked as if he were expecting her to wake and smile at him. Rega came inside, carrying a lantern.
"I've tended the horse."
"My thanks."
Slowly, a broken phrase at a time, Nevin told him the tale, while Rega listened with an occasional nod.
"The poor lass," Rega said at last. "She had more honour than either you or her brother."
"She did. Would it be a wrong thing for me to kill myself on her grave?"
"It would. I forbid it."
Nevin nodded vaguely and wondered why he felt so calm. He was dimly aware of his master leaning over him.
"Lad, she's dead. You've got to go on from here. All we can do for Gwenny now is pray that she has better afterwards."
"Where?"
Nevin bitterly spat out the words.
"In the shadowy otherlands. How can there even be gods if they'd let her die and not kill a wretch like me?"
"Here, lad, you're mad from your grief, and truly I'm afraid you might stay that way if you keep brooding. The gods have nothing to do with this either way. That's true enough."
Rega put a gentle hand on Nevin's arm.
"Come now, let's sit at the table. Let poor little Gwenny lie there."
Nevin's habit of obedience saved him. He He let Rega haul him up and lead him to a table, sat down when the master told him to, and took a tankard of ale as well, just because the master had handed him one.
"Now, drink some of it right off. There, that's better, lad. You think she's gone forever, don't you? Cut off from life, forever and ever, and her, alas, who loved life so much."
"And what else would I think?"
"I'll tell you the truth to think instead. There's a great secret to the Dwayoma, one that you can never tell any man unless he asks you point blank. They do never ask, truly, unless they're marked for the Dwayoma themselves. And the secret is this, that everyone, man and woman both, lives not once, but many times, over and over, back and forth between this world and the other. What looks like a death here, lad, is but a birth to another world. She's gone, truly, but she's gone to that other world, and I swear to you, someone will come to meet her."
"I never thought you'd lie to me. What do you think I am, an infant that can't bear grief without some pretty tale to sweeten it?"
"It's not a lie. And soon, when your training allows, you'll do and see things that will prove the truth of it. Until then, believe me blind."
Nevin hesitated on the edge of trust.
"And in a while," the master went on, "she'll die to that other world and be born again to this one. I can't know if ever your paths will cross again. That's for the great ones, the lords of Weird, to decide, not you and me. Do you still doubt my sworn word?"
"Never could I doubt that."
"Then that's what you have."
Rega gave a long, weary sigh.
"And since men believe the bitter easier than the sweet, I'll tell you somewhat else. If you do meet again, whether in this life or the next, then you have a great debt to make up to her. You've failed her, lad. I'm half-minded to turn you out, but that would only mean I'm failing you. You're going to make this up to her, and the burden won't be an easy one. Maybe it sounds pretty saying you'll meet again, but think about what you owe her. You little fool, you should have recognized her. You thought of her as a jewel or a fine horse, the best woman to ever come your way, better like a prize. Ye gods, under that god-cursed beauty lay a woman to match you in the Dwayoma. Why do you think I hung around the Falcon Keep? How could she ever leave to study the Dwayoma except through the right man? Would her father have ever so nicely let her go off on her own to study her birthright? Why do you think you fell in love with her the moment you saw her? You knew, you dolt, or you should have known. You were a pair, calling to one another."
Rega slammed his hand down on the table.
"But now she's gone."
Nevin turned cold, a sick ripple of shame.
"And some day soon she'll have to start all over again," Rega went on remorselessly. "A little baby, blind, unknowing, years before she can even speak and hold a wretched spoon to feed herself. She'll have to grow up all over again, while the kingdom needs every Dwayoma master it can get, you dolt. By then, who knows where you'll be, you fool."
Nevin broke, falling onto the table to weep on his folded arms. Hastily, Rega got up, laying a gentle hand on his shoulder.
"Oh, here, I'm sorry, lad. There'll be time to talk when you're done mourning. You don't need vinegar poured on your wounds. Here, here, forgive me."
Yet it was a long hour before Nevin could stop weeping. In the morning, Nevin and Rega took Bronwyn into the woods to bury her. As he helped dig her grave, Nevin felt a deathly calm. He lifted her up for the last time and laid her in, then put all the courting presents in with her. Other lives or no, he wanted her to have grave goods, like the princess she should have been. Working together, they filled the grave and built a cairn over it to keep the wild animals from digging her up. Around them, the forest stretched silent and lonely, far from her ancestors. When the last stone lay on the cairn, Rega lifted his arms to the sun.
"It is over,"
Rhaegar called out.
Let her rest.
Nevin fell on his knees at the foot of the cairn.
Bronwyn, my love, forgive me. If we ever meet again, I swear I'll put this right. I swear to you, I'll never rest until I set this right.
Hold your tongue. You don't know what you're offering.
I don't care. I'll swear it anyway. I'll never rest until I put this right.
From the clear sky came a clap of thunder, then another, three mighty hollow knocks rolling and booming over the forest. His face white, Rhaegar stepped back.
The Great Ones have accepted your sacrifice.
After the thunder, the silence rang unbearably loud. Nevin rose, shaking like a man with a fever. Rhaegar shrugged and picked up his shovel.
Well, there you go, lad. A vow's a vow.
When the forest was turning gold and scarlet, and the winds whipped down from the north, Gwerbret Madoc rode their way. Nevin came back from gathering firewood to find his grace's black horse, shield hanging at the saddle bow, standing in front of the hut. He dumped his armload of wood into the bin and ran inside to find Madoc drinking ale with Rhaegar at the table.
"Here's my apprentice, your grace, since you're so interested in meeting him."
"Have you come to kill me?"
Nevin said.
"Don't be a dolt, lad. I came to offer my aid to Bronwyn, but now I hear I'm far too late."
Nevin sat down and felt his grief welling up heavy in his heart.
"How did you find me?"
"By asking here and there. When you were banished, I stayed at court and tried to convince His Highness to recall you. I might as well have tried to squeeze mead out of turnips. So your most noble mother let it slip to me that you'd gone for the Dwaoma, and that there was no hope at all. Then, when I rode to Lady Rother after Blaine's murder, I heard a tale or two from the servants about this strange herbman and his apprentice. Worth a look, think I, but I haven't had the time till now."
"Nicely done," Rhaegar said. "The Gwerbret keeps his eyes open wider than most men."
Madoc winced as if he'd been slapped.
"Here, your grace, just a way of speaking."
"You can't know how deep that cuts," Madoc said, "about Geraint and his god-cursed passion. I saw it, and here like a fool I held my tongue, hoping I was wrong."
"If it's any comfort, there's not a soul in the kingdom who would blame you."
"No comfort at all when a man blames himself. But then I heard that our prince had gotten her away in the end. Well, think I, the least I can do is find the lass before winter and make sure she and the child will be warm."
His voice broke.
"Too late now. I'll never make it up to her."
A cold silence hung in the room.
"How fares Lady Rother?" Rhaegar said at last. "I grieve for her, but I haven't dared to ride her way."
"Well, she's a warrior's wife, and the mother of warriors. Her heart will heal in time. By every god in the sky, I failed Blaine, too. A piss-poor excuse for a man I am, taking a man's fealty and then letting things sweep him to his death."
"And the falcon no longer flies. It's a hard thing to see the death of a clan."
"And death it is truly. The king has given the Falcon's lands to the boar as a blood price for Blaine's murder. What lord will ever take that device again, cursed as it is?"
"True enough."
Nevin joined in.
"And in a while the bards will sing the ballad of Bronwyn and Geraint. I wonder what they'll make of it."
Rhaegar snorted profoundly.
"Summat better than it deserves. Oh, no doubt."
Deveri, 1058. If a man would claim the Dwaoma, he must learn patience above all else. No fruit falls from a tree before it is ripe. The Secret Book of Cadwallon the Druid. 1. So early in the spring, the river water ran cold. Giggling and splashing, Jill jumped up and down in the shallows until she could bear to kneel down on the sandy bottom. Curious wildfolk clustered around, faces that appeared in the ripples, sleek silver forms that darted like fish, while she washed her hair as well as she could without soap. She'd never worried before about being clean, but lately it had grown important. Once she was done, she rolled on the grassy bank like a horse to get dry, then hurried back to the camp among the hazel trees. Out in the meadow beyond, her grey pony and Dar's warhorse were grazing quietly. Cullen himself was still over at a nearby farmhouse buying food. Jill rushed to get dressed before he returned. Just lately, it was troubling to think of Dar seeing her without any clothes. Before she put on her shirt, she looked at her chest and the two definite swellings of little breasts. At times she wished that they would just go away. She was 13, an ominous age since many girls married at 14. Hurriedly she pulled on the shirt and belted it in, then rummaged in the saddlebags and found a comb and a fragment of cracked mirror. The grey gnome, all long nose and warts, materialized next to her. When Jill held up the mirror to him, he looked behind it as if searching for the rest of the gnome he saw there.
"That's you! See? There's your nose!"
The bewildered creature merely sighed and hunkered down on the grass next to her.
"If it was bigger, maybe you'd understand. Dar said he'd buy me a proper mirror for my birthday, but I don't want one. Stupid town lasses primp all the time, but I'm a Silver Dagger's daughter."
The gnome nodded agreement and scratched his armpit. When Cullen returned, they set out riding for Dunmanannan, a coastal town on the eastern border of Deveri province. It turned out to be a collection of wooden houses that straggled along a river where decrepit, aging fishing boats were docked. Rather than having town walls, it merely faded into the surrounding farmlands, and the smell of drying fish was everywhere. On a muddy street that curved up to the river's edge, they found a shabby wooden inn, where the innkeep took Cullen's coin without even a glance at his silver dagger. Since it was market day, the tavern room was crowded with men, a sullen lot by and large, and Jill noticed that a remarkably large number of them wore swords. As soon as they were alone, she asked Cullen if Dunmanannan were a pirate haven.
Nah, they're all smugglers. No stinking boats out in the river are faster than they look. They carry in many a pretty thing under the mackerel.
Doesn't the local lord stop it?
The local lord's in it up to his neck. Now don't you say one word about this out in public, mind.
Once the horses were tended, they went down to the market fair. Down by the river, people had set up wooden booths, but many simply displayed their goods on brown cloths thrown onto the ground. There was food of all sorts, cabbages and greens, cheeses and eggs, live chickens tied upside down onto poles, suckling pigs and rabbits. Cullen brought them each a chunk of roast pork on a stick to eat as they looked at the booths with cloth, pottery and metalwork.
"I don't see any fancy lace. Pity. I wanted to buy you some for your birthday."
"Oh, da, I don't want that sort of thing."
"Indeed? Then what about a pretty dress?"
"Da."
"A new doll? Jewelry?"
"Da, you best be jesting."
"Naught of the sort. Here, I know a jeweler in this town, and I'll wager he's not even at the fair. Come along."
Down near the edge of town where the green commons met the last houses, they came to a silver shop with a wooden sign painted with a silver brooch. When Cullen pushed open the door, silver bells jingled melodiously above. The chamber was just a thin slice of the roundhouse, cut off by an intricate wickerwork partition. The doorway in the wickerwork was covered by an old green blanket.
"Otho," Cullen called, "are you here?" "I am,"
a deep voice said from within.
"Would I be leaving the door unlocked if I weren't?"
The owner of the voice shoved aside the blanket and came out. He was the shortest man Jill had ever seen, just about 5 feet tall, but broad-shouldered and heavily muscled like a miniature blacksmith. He had a thick shock of grey hair, a tidy grey beard, and piercing black eyes.
"Cullen of Caermore, by the gods! Who's this with you? Your son, from the look of him?"
"My daughter, in truth, and I want to buy her a trinket for her birthday."
"A lass, are you?"
Otho looked Jill over carefully.
"Well, so you are, and one old enough to be thinking about her dowry at that. We'd best turn some of your Dar's coin into jewels, then, before he drinks the lot away.
Otho led them into the workshop, a thick slice of the house. In the center, just under the smoke hole in the roof, were a hearth and a small forge. Off to one side stood a long, low workbench, scattered with tools, wooden boxes, and a half-eaten meal of bread and smoked meat. Lying in the clutter were a handful of small rubies. Cullen picked one up and held it so that it caught the light.
"Nice stones." "They are, but I'll trouble you to not ask where I got them."
With a grin, Cullen rolled the ruby back onto the bench. Otho perched on the stool and had a thoughtful bite of bread.
"Brooches, rings, bracelets," he said with his mouth full. "Or does she want a jeweled coffer? Earrings, maybe?"
"None of those, truly, but a silver dagger."
Jill laughed, a crow of victory, and threw her arms around him. With a sly smile, Cullen untangled himself and gave her a kiss on the cheek.
"Now that's a strange gift for a lass,"
Otho said.
"Not for this little hellcat here. She's badgered her old father here into teaching her swordcraft."
Otho turned to Jill in surprise. The grey gnome popped into existence, squatting on the workbench, and laid one long, warty finger on a ruby. Jill reached out and swatted it away, then realized from the way that Otho's eyes were moving that he too could see it. With an injured look, the gnome vanished. Otho gave Jill a bland, conspiratorial smile.
"Well, lass, no doubt you'll want the same falcon device as your da."
"By the asses of the gods, Otho," Cullen broke in. "It was 14 years ago when you made me my dagger. You've got a cursed long memory."
"I do. Memory serves a man well if he'll only use it. Now, you're in a bit of luck. I've got a dagger all made up, so all I have to do is grave the device on. A year or so ago, another silver dagger brought me a lad to pledge to your band. I got the dagger finished, but cursed if the lad didn't go and ask questions about the fishing boats, and so he never lived to pay me for it. Luckily, I'd never put on the device, or I'd have been out a good bit of coin."
Late in the afternoon, Jill went back to the smith's to get the finished dagger. She ran greedy hands over the hilt and a cautious finger down the blade. While an ordinary Daveri craftsman would have drawn a falcon as a circle for a head on top of a pair of triangles for wings, Otho's work was a lifelike side view, detailed to give the illusion of feathers, and yet it was only an inch tall.
"This is truly beautiful," Jill said.
The gnome materialized for a look. When Jill obligingly held the dagger up, Otho laughed under his breath.
"You're a strange one, young Jill," Otho said, "seeing the wild folk as clear as day."
"Oh, I'm strange, am I now? Good smith, you see them too."
"So I do, so I do. But why I do is my secret and not for the telling. As for you, lass, is there elven blood in your mother's clan? You can tell by looking at him that there's no such thing in Cullen's."
"What? How could there be? Elves are only a children's tale."
"Oh, are they now? Well, the elves you hear about are a tale and no more, perhaps, but that's because no one round here knows about the true elves. They're called the Elkian Lekar, they are, and if you ever meet one, don't trust him a jot. Flighty they are, all of that lot."
Jill smiled politely, but she was sure that Otho must be daft. He put his chin on his hand and considered her.
"Tell me summat," he said at last. "Does it suit you riding with your father? Cullen's a cursed harsh man."
"Not to me. Well, most of the time not to me. But it's splendid getting to go everywhere and see everything."
"And what's going to happen when it's time for you to marry?"
"I'll never marry."
Otho smiled in pronounced skepticism.
"Well, some women never marry," Jill said. "They get a craft, like spinning or such like, and they open a shop."
"True enough, and maybe you will find the right craft some day. Here, young Jill, I'll tell you a riddle. If ever you find no one, ask him what craft to take."
"Your pardons, but what—"
"Told you it was a riddle, didn't I? Remember, if you ever find Nevin, he'll tell you more. Now, you'd best get back to your Dar before he gives you a slap for dawdling.
All the way back to the inn, Jill puzzled over Otho and his riddle both. Finally, she decided that the riddle meant that no one could ever tell her what to do, because she'd do exactly what she wanted. Otho himself, however, was not so easily solved.
"Da," she asked, "what sort of a man is Otho?"
"What? What do you mean by that?"
"Well, he doesn't seem like an ordinary man."
Cullen shrugged in vague irritation.
"Well, it must be hard on a man being born that short," he said at last. "I suppose that's what makes him so gruff and grasping. Just to begin with, what lass would ever have him?"
Jill supposed that his answer made sense, but still, she was left with the feeling that there was something very odd about Otho the silversmith. That evening, the tavern room filled up fast with merchants who'd been to the fair, and farmers having a last tankard before they went home. Although the room was hot from the fire in the hearth, and clouds of midges swarmed around the candle lanterns, Cullen showed no inclination to leave after dinner. With coin in his pocket he would drink all night, Jill knew, and she got ready to argue with him later to keep him from spending the lot. Eventually, four riders in the local Lord's Warband, wearing fox blazons on their shirts, came in to drink and chivy the serving lass. Jill kept a nervous eye on them. Three of them were laughing and talking, but the fourth stood on the edge of things. Since he looked no older than 15, doubtless he had yet to prove himself in battle or in a brawl. Jill hoped that he wouldn't be stupid enough to challenge Cullen, because he was a handsome lad in his way. All at once she realized that he was boldly looking back at her. She grabbed her tankard of ale and buried her nose in it.
"Not so fast," Cullen snapped.
"My apologies, Dar. Here, shall I fetch you another? The tavernman's so busy he never looks our way."
Jill got the ale from the tavernman and began making her way back, carefully keeping her eye on the foaming full tankard. When she felt a touch on her shoulder, she looked up to find the young rider, grinning at her.
"Hold a minute," he said. "Can I ask you summat?"
"You can, but I might not answer."
The other fox riders gathered round and snickered. The lad blushed and went on in wavering determination.
No insult, mind. But are you a lad or a lass?"
"A lass, but it's nothing to you."
The riders laughed. One nudged the lad and whispered,
"Oh, go on." Well, I thought you were a lass because you're so pretty."
Jill was caught speechless.
"Well, you are," the lad went on a bit more boldly. "Can I stand you a tankard?"
"Now here."
It was Cullen striding over.
"What's this?"
"He was just talking to me, Da."
The lad stepped back sharply, stumbling into his friends.
"Listen, you young dolt. I happen to be Cullen of Caremore. Ever hear that name?"
The lad's face went pale. The other fox riders jostled each other in their hurry to fall back and leave the lad to face Cullen alone.
"I see you have," Cullen said. "Now, none of you are going to say one more word to my daughter."
"We won't. I swear it."
"Good."
Cullen turned on Jill.
"And you're not saying one more word to them. Get back to the table."
Slopping the ale a bit, Jill hurried back to the table and sat down. Cullen stood with his arms folded over his chest, while the fox riders unceremoniously ran out the door. Then he came and sat beside her.
"You listen to me. The next time any young lout says a wrong word to you, you walk on by and find me. By the hells, you're getting older, aren't you? I never truly noticed how much older before."
When their eyes met, Jill felt that she'd somehow become shameful and failed him. She disliked the way her father was looking at her, too, a cold appraisal that made her feel unclean. Abruptly, he looked away, and she knew that he was as troubled as she was. She sat there miserably and wished that she could talk to her mother. It was only later that she remembered the young rider telling her she was pretty. In spite of herself, she was pleased. 2. On a day when the trees stood scarlet and a cold drizzle turned the streets to muck, Nevin rode into Dunmananan. He rented a chamber in the inn, stabled his horse and pack mule, then wrapped himself in his patched cloak and hurried to the shop of Otho the silversmith. For reasons of its own, the Dwayomer watched over the band of silver daggers, since most of them were decent enough lads who had only committed one grave fault. They came in handy on those rare times when the Dwayomer needed some help from the sword. Nevin knew every smith in the kingdom who served them, though few were as strange as Otho, a dwarf in long exile from the kingdoms of his race far to the north. When Nevin appeared at his door, the silversmith greeted him heartily and took him into the workshop where a fire burned on the hearth.
"Would you care for a bit of mulled ale, my lord?"
"I would. These old bones are feeling the damp."
Otho allowed himself a smile at the jest. They had, after all, known each other for some 200 years. Nevin pulled the only chair in the room up to the fire and held out his hands to the heat while Otho bustled around, filling a metal flagon with ale from the barrel by the wall, adding a stick of Bardex cinnamon, then popping on a lid to keep the ashes out when he stood the flagon in the coals.
"I was hoping you'd ride my way," Otho said. "I might have a bit of news for you. That lass of yours, the one you've been vexing yourself over for so long, is it time for her to be reborn again?"
"She's been born, actually. Here, have you seen her?"
"I may have, I may not. I don't have the second sight, my lord, or the Dwayomer neither, as well you know. But a passing strange little lass rode my way this summer. Her name was Jill, and oh, she'd been born some 13 summers ago, I'd say. Her father's a silver dagger, you see, and he has his daughter riding with him. It's truly strange to see a human being treat his child so well, but that's neither here nor there. His name's Cullen of Caermore. Ever heard of him?"
"The man, they say, is the best swordsman in Deverry."
"The very one, and he is, too. His mark is the striking falcon."
"Oh, by the gods, it could be. It just could be."
Otho got a clot of rags and gingerly took the flagon from the fire, then poured the steaming ale into a pair of tankards.
13 would mark the right number of years since I saw that vision, Nevin thought, and it would be like Geraint to end up with that dagger in his belt.
If she were wandering with a silver dagger, it was no wonder he'd never found her in all his long years of trying. Suddenly he felt weary. For all that Cullen of Caermore had great glory, it would be a hard job to track him down. Otho handed him a tankard.
"When they left here, they rode north. Cullen took a hire with a merchant who was taking a caravan of our, special imports into Deverry." "Special imports, indeed. Here, Otho, when are you going to mend your ways?"
"It's your people, not mine, who make such a stinking fuss over excises and the king's tax."
Although Nevin was tempted to ride after the pair, by that time of year it would already be snowing up north, and for all he knew, Cullen would be riding elsewhere. Nevin decided to carry out his original plan of returning to his home in Western Eldith for winter. After all, he reminded himself, this Jill might not even be his Bronwyn reborn. She wasn't the only soul in the kingdom marked for the Dwayomer, and the falcon device might well be a simple coincidence. Besides, he also had Lord Hrodri Maelwith of Aberwyn to consider. He was as much a part of Nevin's weird as Bronwyn was, being as Lord Blaine had died so needlessly that night, thanks to Prince Gowrion's fault. Although Nevin had been planning on riding straight to Aberwyn, he took the precaution of scrying Hrodri out first and so saved himself a wasted trip. When he called up Hrodri's image in the burning coals of a fire, he saw the lad out riding in the forest preserve of the Goerbrets of Aberwyn, a stretch of virgin forest near the little town of Belgleith. Nevin assumed that he would have no chance to meet the young lord, simply because the preserve was close to all but Goerbretial guests. But even so, he went to Belgleith on the off chance that Hrodri might ride into town for some reason. There, as he later came to realize, the lords of Weird took a hand in the matter. The people of Belgleith and the outlying farmers both knew and honored Nevin, because he was the only source of medical care that most of them had. The tavernman insisted on putting him up for free, and then rattled off a list of symptoms about the pains in his joints. For the next week, Nevin had little time to think about his tangled weird, as family after family came to buy his herbs and ask his advice. On the 8th morning, Nevin had just gone out to the muddy tavern yard for a bit of sun, when a rider trotted up in a splash of muck. He wore a blue cloak blazoned with the dragon device of Aberwyn.
"Morrow, aged sir," the rider said. "I hear there's a good herbman in town. Do you know him?"
"I am him, lad. What's the trouble?"
"I've just come from the lodge. Lord Rodri's cursed ill."
Talking all the while, the rider helped Nevin load his supplies onto his mule. Rodri had been caught out in the rain and stubbornly gone on hunting, even though he was soaking wet. The only people at the lodge with him were a pair of servants and five of his father's men, none of whom knew the first thing about physic.
"And what's his lordship doing out here this time of year anyway?" Nevin said.
"Oh, well, sir, I'm not free to say, but he got into a bit of trouble with his older brother. Not that was serious."
Although the Gwerbret probably considered his hunting lodge to be charmingly rustic, it was as imposing as many had done of a lesser lord. In the middle of a cobbled and well-drained ward rose a three-story broch, surrounded by enough outbuildings and stables to house a party of 100 guests. An aged manservant led Nevin up to the second floor and Rodri's chamber, sparsely furnished with one carved chest, a bed with faded hangings, and his lordship's shield hanging on the wall. Although there was a brazier heaped with coals glowing in the middle of the room, the damp seeped out of the very walls.
"Ye gods!" Nevin snapped.
"Isn't there a chamber with a proper hearth?"
"There is, but his lordship won't let us move him."
"Indeed. Then I'll deal with his lordship."
When Nevin pulled back the bed curtains, Rodri looked up at him with gummy eyes. At 16, he'd grown into a lanky lad, getting close to 6 feet tall, and still as handsome as ever. Or he would have been handsome, if his hair weren't plastered to his forehead with sweat, his lips not so badly cracked that they were bleeding, and his cheeks not flushed with a hectic glow.
"Who are you?" Rodri mumbled.
"A herbman. Your men fetched me."
"Ah, curse them! I don't need—"
He began to cough so violently that his body went rigid. He propped himself up on one elbow and spasmed, choking, until Nevin grabbed him and hauled him upright. Finally, he spat out green rheum.
"You don't need me," Nevin said dryly. "I may only be a commoner, your lordship, but you're following my orders."
Rodri's lips twitched in a faint smile as he trembled with fever. Nevin laid him down again and turned to the frightened manservant.
"Get that chamber with the hearth warm, then pile extra pillows on the bed and start heating me a big kettle of water. When you've done all that, send a man back to Aberwyn with a message. Gwerbret Tinga needs to know that his son is ill."
All that afternoon, Nevin worked over his patient. He fed Rodri infusions of coltsfoot and elecamp to bring up the phlegm, hyssop and pennyroyal to make him sweat, and quaking aspen as a general febrifuge. As the medicines cleansed his humours, Rodri coughed until it made Nevin's own sides ache to hear him. But at last he began to breathe freely, instead of gasping for every breath. Nevin let him lie down then, propped up on the mound of pillows. The fever still played on his face like firelight.
"My thanks," Rodri whispered. "Owain, does he still live?"
For a moment Nevin was too puzzled to answer him. Then the memory came back, of another life, when he'd tended battle wounds on the body this soul wore then, and a friend lay dying nearby.
"He does, lad. Just rest."
Rodri smiled and fell straight asleep.
"So," Nevin thought, "he's reacting to my presence, is he?"
In his feverish state, Rodri had somehow come across that long-buried memory. All the next day, Nevin brooded over his patient, forcing him to drink bitter infusions of herbs, even though Rodri swore at him and complained that he couldn't get another loathsome mouthful down. Finally, that evening, the fever broke. Rodri was well enough to eat a little thin soup, which Nevin fed to him a mouthful at a time.
"My thanks," Rodri said when he was finished. "It's a marvel, you turning up like this. Do you remember meeting me on the Contray Road all those years ago?"
"I do, truly."
"It's eerie. I was just trying to be courteous. I never dreamt you'd save my life some day. I must have cursed good luck."
"So you must. So you must."
When Rodri fell asleep, Nevin went down to the great hall for his dinner. The men and the young lord's warband insisted on treating Nevin like a hero. They brought him his food like pages and crowded round to thank him while he ate. One of them, a beefy lad named Preath, even insisted on bringing Nevin a goblet of mead.
"Here, good sir. If you ever need our aid for anything, me and the lads will ride out of our way to give it."
"My thanks. I take it you men honour Lord Rodri highly."
"We do. He's young yet, but he's got more honour than any lord in Eldith."
"Well and good, then. And what of Lord Rhys, the heir?"
Preath hesitated, glancing this way and that, and he dropped his voice when he answered.
"Don't spread this around, like, but there's plenty of men in Avawyn who wish Lord Rodri had been born first, not second."
Preath bowed and hurried away before he could say anything else indiscreet. As Nevin thought over what he'd said, he felt a cold Dwayoma warning ripple down his back. There was trouble coming in Abawin. Suddenly, he had a brief flash of vision, saw swords flashing in the summer sun as Rodri led a wedge of men into a hard-fought battle. When the vision faded, Nevin felt sick at heart. Was there going to be a rebellion to put Rodri in the Gwerbretiel chair when Tinga died? Perhaps. Dwayoma warnings were always vague, leaving the recipient to puzzle out their meaning. Yet he could guess that once again he would have important work to do in Abawin when the time came. The guess turned to a certainty late on the next afternoon. Nevin was up in Rodri's chamber when a manservant rushed in with the news that Rodri's mother, Lady Levian of Aberwyn, had arrived with a small retinue. In a few minutes, the wife of the most powerful man in Eldith swept into the room. She threw her travel-stained plaid cloak to the waiting servant and ran to Rodri's bedside. A solid woman in her early 40s, Levian had an imposing beauty, her raven-dark hair just streaked with grey, her cornflower blue eyes as large and perfect as her son's.
"My poor little lad," she said, laying a hand on his forehead. "Thanks be to the goddess, you're not fevered any more.
The goddess sent a good herbman. Mother, you didn't need to ride all this way just for me."
"Don't babble nonsense." Levian turned to Nevin. "My thanks, good sir. I'll see you're well paid for all of this."
"It was my honour, my lady. I'm just thankful that I was close at hand."
Nevin left them alone, but later he returned to find Rodri asleep and Levian sitting by his bedside. When Nevin bowed to her, she came over to talk where they wouldn't waken him.
"I've spoken to the servants, good Nevin. They told me that they feared for his life until you came."
"I won't lie to you, my lady. He was very ill indeed. That's why I thought you should be notified."
Levian nodded, her mouth slack with worry. In the fading light, she looked intensely familiar. Nevin allowed himself to slip into the Dwayoma sight and saw her clearly, Rotha, bound to Blaine again as mother to son. At that moment, she recognized him as well, and her eyes grew puzzled even as she smiled.
"Now here, do you ever ride to Aberwyn? I must have seen you before, but surely I'd remember a man with such an unusual name."
"Oh, my lady, you may have seen me when you rode by in the street or such like. I'd never be presented to a woman of your rank."
Nevin felt like laughing in triumph. Here they were, three of them come together at the same time as he'd had news of the lass who might be Bronwyn. Surely the time was ripening. Surely his weird was leading him to one of those crisis points when he would have the chance to untangle it. In his excitement, he forgot himself badly. The fire was growing low. He tossed on a couple of big logs, then waved his hand over them. When the flames leapt up, he heard Levian gasp. He spun round to face her.
My apologies, my lady, for startling you.
No apology needed, my lord. Levian pronounced the honorific slowly and deliberately. I'm most honored that a man like you would stoop to treating my son for a fever.
I see that my lady doesn't dismiss tales of Dwaelmer as nonsense fit only to amuse children.
Her ladyship has seen too many odd things in her life to do anything of the sort. For a moment they studied each other like a pair of fencers. Then Nevin felt the Dwaelmer prod him, force him to speak, as if his mouth would burn if he didn't speak out the truth.
It is very important for Rodri to live to his manhood. I cannot tell you why, but his weird is Eldith's weird. I would like to be able to keep an eye on the lad from now on.
Levian went tense, her face pale in the leaping firelight. Finally, she nodded her agreement. His lordship is always welcome at the court of Aberwyn, and if he prefers, I shall keep up the fiction that this shabby old herbman amuses me.
I do prefer, and my thanks.
That night, Nevin stayed up late, leaning on the windowsill of his guest chamber and watching the moon sail through the wind-torn and scudding clouds. He had been sent to his post like a soldier, and he would do nothing but obey. From now on, he would stay in Eldith and trust that the Lords of Weird would send Bronwyn to him when the time was ripe. Deep in his heart, he felt true hope for the first time in hundreds of years. Great things were on the move. He could only wait and watch for their coming. Deveri 698. And the bard is picked out by his Agwen, not only to delight his lord, but to remember all the great deeds and great men in his clan, all in their proper order. For if men were without knowledge of anything but the name of each man's father, then the children of bondsmen would be as noble or as base as the children of a Gwerbret. Therefore, let no man, or woman either, commit the impiety of raising his hand against a bard. The Edicts of King Bran. Heat shimmered on dead grass and stunted grain. Brackish brown water trickled between the banks of what had once been the River Nur. Stripped to the waist, a herdsman led eager cows down to suck water that was mostly mud. Gwerin the bard stood on the bank and watched for a moment, then glanced up at the sky, a crystal dome of pure blue, stubbornly clear. Although he'd come for a walk in the fields to work on a song he was composing, his heart spoke only of drought and the long cold winter of starvation that would follow. With a shudder, he turned away from the river and walked back to the dun of the White Wolf clan. Ringed with earthworks, the small fort lay on top of a low hill. Behind the inner log palisade rose a squat stone broch, its slits of windows brooding like eyes over the dusty ward. Except for a few drowsy flies, the ward was deserted in the hot sun. Gwerin hurried into the great hall, blessedly cool in the embrace of stone walls. Down by the empty hearth, Lord Marowick sat at the head of the honour table. With him were two priests of Bell, dressed in their long white tunics and gold torques, their fresh-shaven heads shiny with sweat. When Gwerin knelt at his lord's side, the head priest, Obin, smiled at him, his eyes narrow under pouched lids. Lord Marowick, a florid-faced man in his 30s, with pale hair and pale moustache, stopped in mid-sentence to speak to his bard.
"I was hoping you'd return straight away. A question for you. I don't suppose a bard can invoke the rain."
"I only wish I could. I should think His Holiness here would be the one to do that for us."
"His lordship and I have been discussing just that," Obin said. "We are considering a horse sacrifice to placate the gods."
"No doubt such an act of piety would be bound to please Great Bell."
Obin considered him, while his young companion looked wistfully at the flagon of ale on the table.
"The question is why Bell is angry with us," Obin said finally. "A sacrifice will fail if a curse hangs over the land."
"And does His Holiness think there is such a curse?" Gwerin said.
"His Holiness doesn't know."
Obin allowed himself a thin-lipped smile.
A priest may read the omens of the future, but only a bard can read the past.
Gwyrin sighed when he realized what Oban was asking of him. That life-draining ritual of the opening of the well, where a bard may dream himself into the past and talk with the spirits of those long dead. He was tempted to refuse, but if there was no crop...
A bard may try to read the past, Your Holiness, but I can only see what my Agwen shows me. By her grace I'll be of some use. Will you witness?
I will, and gladly. Tonight?
And why not? When the moon is rising, I'll come to the temple.
To rest before his ordeal, Gwyrin went up to his chambers on the third floor of the Broch, two rooms opening off the central landing by the spiral staircase, one for his children and servant, one for himself and his wife. The main chamber displayed Lord Marowick's proper generosity to his bard, a heavy bed, hung with embroidered hangings, a carved chest, a table and two chairs, and a small bardic carpet. On the table stood his two harps, the small plain lap harp, the tall, heavily carved standing harp for formal presentations. Gwyrin idly plucked a few strings and smiled at the soft, resonant echo. As if the sound were a signal, his wife Lisa came in through the door of the children's chamber. Although she was a pretty woman, with raven dark hair and large blue eyes, her greatest beauty was her voice, soft, husky, with a musical lilt to it like wind in the trees. Her voice had snared Gwyrin's heart from the first time he'd heard it, those 10 long years ago, when she was a lass of 15, and he at 25 could finally think of marrying after his long training.
"There you are, my love," Lisa said. "Are the priests still down in the hall? I came up here to get away from them."
"Oh, they're gone. I'm going to the temple tonight to work with them."
Lisa gasped, her soft lips parting. Laughing, Gwyrin took her hands in his.
"Oh, now here. They won't lay me on the altar like in the dawn time."
"I know. There's just summat about priests that makes you feel better if they never look your way. Do you want to sleep? I'll keep the lads outside if you do."
"My thanks, because I'd better."
That night Gwyrin fasted through the evening meal. Just at twilight he fetched his grey gelding from the stables and rode out through a twilight as hot as a summer noon. Overhead in the opalescent sky, the full moon hung bloated on the horizon, shedding its silver light over farmland and forest. 4 miles to the north of the Dun stood the temple, built of wood and roofed with thatch, set among a small stand of oaks. When Gwyrin led his horse into the trees, a young priest was there to meet him, moving sure-footed in the darkness. He took the reins of Gwyrin's horse.
"I'll take it round to the stable. His Holiness is waiting for you in the temple."
Inside the small circular shrine, candle lanterns cast a pool of golden light before the stone altar. Draped in the long white cloak of ritual working, Oban stood off to one side, his hands raised to the statue of the god, carved of a single oak trunk, whose bark still clung for clothes on the abstract body. The head itself was beautifully modelled, with great staring eyes and a mobile mouth. 2 wooden heads hung by their wooden hair from its delicate hands. Lying in front of the altar was a thick pile of tanned white sheepskins.
"Is the temple suitable for the working?"
Oban said.
"It is, if the god will allow my goddess to share his abode."
"I have no doubt that Great Bell will allow everything that will aid his people."
Oban's eyes blinked and fluttered.
"Since he is, after all, the lord of all gods and goddesses."
Rather than engage in religious controversy at the wrong moment, Gwyrin smiled and knelt down by the pile of sheepskins. He spread them out to make a rough bed, then lay down on his back and crossed his arms over his chest. He let himself go limp until he felt like a corpse laid out for burial. Oban knelt down by his feet. The old man moved slowly and stiffly as he sat back on his heels.
"Can His Holiness kneel there all night?"
"His Holiness can do what needs to be done."
Gwyrin stared up at the ceiling and watched the candle-thrown shadows dancing. It had been a long time since he'd performed this ritual last, to talk to the spirit of an ancient bard of the Wolf Clan to clarify a confusing point of Mariok's genealogy. Now, a great deal more than a lord's vanity depended on the working. He let his breathing slow until he seemed to float, not rest, on the soft fleece. The candle-thrown shadows danced in silence, broken only by the soft rhythmic breathing of the old priest.